from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support for the legislature today is provided by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Learn more at aarp.org/WV. The Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Lumos Networks, online at lumosnetworks.com. Marshall University, with more than 100 degree programs offered in 4 locations and online. More about the Marshall family at marshall.edu. Orion Strategies, professional public relations, government affairs, creative services, and research and polling, with offices in Charleston, Buchanan, Martinsburg, Pittsburgh, and Columbus.
Good evening and welcome to the Legislature Today from the State Capitol Building. Tonight, a look at House Bill 2010, a revamping of the state foster care system. But first, Senate Bill 1, creating a grant program to pay the remaining tuition balance for community and technical college students. Dave Mistich reports it was on the amendment stage today in the Senate.
First proposed amendment to Senate Bill 1 would have allowed students to use the grant towards tuition for an already existing associate's degree program at any of the state's four-year institutions. Senate Minority Leader Roman Prezioso proposed the change after leaders of four-year institutions expressed concerns over declining enrollment and argued that the bill gives favor to community colleges.
I look at this Senate Bill 1 and all the things that we're trying to do and things that we don't intend to do, we don't want any unintended consequences. We've got to make every avenue available for every student. And when we look at our declining enrollments, both in the public education sector and in the higher education sector, there's a target population out there that we're trying to reach. And it's not a large target population. And we have to afford the students that are left now in our school system the opportunity to obtain whatever career path that they may want.
With Democrats rising in support and Republicans arguing that the amendment would broaden the number of applications and drive up costs to the state, Senate President Mitch Carmichael eventually left his spot at the podium to address the proposed amendment.
I rise in opposition to the amendment for a couple reasons. And it's primarily the aspect that's been enunciated or articulated about the program itself. This is a targeted program that addresses a demographic that's going to lift a certain socioeconomic segment to a higher level, to a better place in their life.
But Carmichael also pointed to opposition in the House in an unexpected context. As the Senate was in session debating amendments to the Community College Grant Program, Delegate Jim Butler announced he would challenge Carmichael in 2020.
I'll probably make a mistake saying this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. It's all politics, right? Somebody just filed around against me in the 4th senatorial district because they need a real conservative in the district, not someone who's creating an entitlement program for free college and tuition. That's what you're dealing with. So to the degree that we continue to escalate the cost of this program, as we do every good idea that comes through here, there are opportunities for further expansion later as we move through the process. But if we're going to, we can all destroy a great idea.
The amendment failed on a 14-20 party line vote. Another amendment offered by Senator Bob Plymel and other Democrats would have encouraged but not required community and technical colleges to enter into collaborative agreements with federally registered apprenticeship programs.
We're all talking about West Virginia citizens here. And we owe it to the West Virginia citizens to give them every opportunity to have a job and a career pathway. We also talk about industries. And right now, when we talk about industries and in the construction area particularly with the road building, I mean, we were in transportation recently talking about that, but the needs for people with trades and abilities and skills.
After pushback from Republicans, that amendment was rejected on a 15-19 vote, with Senator Bill Hamilton being the only Republican to break with the majority party. Senate Bill 1 now moves to a full vote in the chamber on Wednesday. The bill includes some eligibility requirements. In order for students to receive the tuition grant, students must successfully pass a drug test prior to each semester of enrollment and remain in West Virginia for 2 years following completion of a program. For the legislature today, I'm Dave Mistich at the Capitol.
A bill that would significantly restructure the state's foster care system passed out of the House Health and Human Resources Committee this afternoon after a public hearing this morning. The bill would shift the health care of foster care children to a managed care system. It also seeks to make it easier to recruit foster parents. We'll discuss the bill further in just a few minutes, but first, highlights from that public hearing.
Our concern is that this is moving forward too fast. We're not looking at what has been successful here in West Virginia, what we can grow from, how we can involve our communities and our foster parents directly in that. And just a little breakdown on some math here. So if we're talking about $33 million going out in profit or going out to a managed care organization outside of our state, that $33 million could easily break down into $600,000 per county to improve the services for foster care children in that community based on that needs of that community. It also breaks down another way if you want to look at it differently, 6,700 young people in foster care. That means I have not just three children at home, I have 6,703 children that I have as a West Virginian. And those children with that same money, we could have $5,000 more per child to seek the necessary services that they need.
As healthcare advocates, over the past few years, we have heard stories from foster families who have told us that children are being placed in their care with a variety of health care, mental health issues, in need of immediate attention. However, often they will come with no health records, no health histories. They may have medications that the foster parent doesn't know what the child is being prescribed for. They may not even know who the last doctor was that the child has seen. Yet now they're responsible for this child's health with little or no information or records to work from. We believe that an MCO program could really help with this type of situation. For this specific population of children and families, this is a meaningful opportunity.
Being a foster parent is the hardest thing my wife and I have ever done. Meanwhile, we must also navigate eight separate people with eight separate interests along the way. A DHHR worker, CHS worker, guardian ad litem, judge, two attorneys, a CASA worker, and a prosecutor. Those folks are necessary. But now you want to add a ninth person, an insurance claims person whose job depends on making his insurance company some money. When they tried something like this in Texas, it was found that the company denied 10 doctor-recommended treatments per day. Thousands of formal complaints were lodged by nurses, by parents, by judges, and even by employees of the insurance company about inadequate services. When something similar was tried in Kentucky, they found that the main way the company made its money was by reducing the output of behavioral health services by 9%. That's 1 in 11 children not getting services, and I don't want that to be my son.
MCOs do have the expertise, the experience, and the flexibility in program design to work with the agencies involved in the children's lives to jointly develop the most effective and comprehensive system of care. MCOs integrate the full child's life experience, healthcare, welfare, education, career preparation for transition age youth, and other social services and supports in collaboration with the state agencies and creating a single point of accountability, and that's been lacking. This, in turn, significantly increases the likelihood for improved outcomes, safety, stability, and overall well-being.
We really need to have a fiscal note, see what it would cost, see what we could do to spend the money here and not for an out-of-state group. Another thing is it would make services, it would put another layer on getting Medicaid and other services to our children. So how much will that cost and how much longer will that take and how much more difficult would that be for foster parents? And the other thing is that there's a lot of research out there showing that managed care organizations have bad outcomes. So I will be very short. It seems to me that not to do some slow down, as people have said, do a really detailed, careful study of this bill, because I'm sure the people who want to do this, they want to help West Virginians. They don't want to hurt West Virginians, but this bill could do just that.
There have been many questions surrounding managed care, and we understand. When contemplating a shift in policy, one should ask tough questions, and you are. But managed care is not new to West Virginia, and it's certainly not new to serving vulnerable populations. Managed care has had a role in West Virginia's Medicaid program since 1996. Currently, MCOs manage the care of roughly 400,000 West Virginians, 150,000 of which are children.
We're being told that managed care is a silver bullet to solve the foster care crisis. But what problems does it solve? Most foster parents right now report that their medical card works very well, that they're able to take their child almost anywhere in the state and know that they'll get the services they need without question if those services are available. This is one of the few parts of the foster care system that seems to be working pretty well. Instead, we want to establish a $330 million contract, roughly, with a private, probably out-of-state corporation, and $33 million of that would go toward their administrative and profits, administrative costs and profits. There's a lot of other things that we could do with $33 million that would help with this foster care crisis. We could put it into prevention. We could put it into much-needed peer support and training for foster, adoptive, and kinship parents, post-adoption supports, better services for children, such as an increase in the number of certified play therapists in the state, treatments for things, very complex issues that many kids in foster care face, like reactive attachment disorder, and trauma-informed providers, which are very, very difficult to find right now.
If there's one thing I want to say emphatically, it's this. This crisis, the foster care crisis, the welfare, child welfare crisis, whatever you'd like to call it, it is a health care crisis. These kids need access to comprehensive health care. The system doesn't need a slight adjustment. It's broken. It needs bold reform. Because of this, I support the creation of an MCO program. If the legislature chooses not to act on the MCO program, please do not walk away from this program or this problem. Have a plan in place before a session ends to help West Virginia's most vulnerable children. It would be unconscionable if we wait a moment longer. Thank you.
Joining me now are Mr. Sam Hickman, Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, West Virginia Chapter, and Mr. Jim McKay, State Director of Prevent Child Abuse, West Virginia. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
The two of you also appeared at the public hearing this morning. And of course, it's a very big bill and it attempts to do quite a bit. This afternoon, it passed out of the House, the House Health, and is now in House Judiciary. I wanted to mention that we had invited both the lead sponsor of the bill, Delegate Kayla Kessinger, and also the chair of the House Health Committee, Delegate Joe Ellington, and both had previous engagements and weren't able to join us this evening. Now, Mr. Hickman, we'll begin with you. House Bill 2010, you have described it as a scattershot approach to the care and safety of our children in foster care. Your overarching objection to this bill?
The bill takes
different segments of a very difficult and complex system and pulls them out and attempts to, quote unquote, reform them in very, really essentially small sound bites within this bill. The managed care organization provisions itself, you're really just expressing the intent of the legislature to support DHHR's already announced desire to move to managed care for the foster care population. That has no real bearing on anything. They're just saying, this is how we would like you to do it if you're going to do it. So there were some discussion about that today. The foster care provisions, from my perspective, we should be more concerned about how to make foster families successful, how to make foster parents successful, than be concerned about recruiting families more rapidly. They need more supports than they're getting now. That's very true. But the legislature really just needs to express its intent that children need to be safe, they need to be in families where they can have as normal an experience as possible, and that our rules process should reflect that as it moves forward, because all this is going to go into legislative rules.
Mr. McKay, the same question. You have spoken against the bill as it currently is. Articulate that position for us.
Certainly. It's a pleasure to be here. So Prevent Child Abuse West Virginia applauds the goals of the legislation. I think all of us share a commitment to our children and their future. However, in the approach that's been outlined that relies overwhelmingly on a managed care organization approach that would be implemented in a very quick process at a scope that no other state has done so far. And so looking at the experience of other states that have transitioned foster families into a managed care situation, those that have taken a more deliberative approach seem to be more effective. The state of New York took 5 years to implement for a smaller scope. West Virginia is looking at a process of less than a year of implementation, not just health care, but also socially necessary services.
And what is that about? That was pointed out in the meeting this morning, that there are 41 other states that have gone to managed care for their children in the foster care program, but this is the only one that would manage the physical, emotional, and social needs. What does that mean?
So there's a variety of socially necessary services that are currently being provided by community-based efforts. It could be parenting support, different aspects, a parenting support group, maybe some aspect of in-home counseling support and so forth, but it's not medically necessary. You don't have a diagnosis per se, but it's the social aspects of how we work together as families in a community, accessing both formal supports as well as informal supports, and how we build that, and that's the goal we're trying to achieve, is how do we strengthen our community-based system to where we have access points that are easy to access and don't require prior authorization and aspects like that. So socially necessary services is harder to define. It's harder to do that analysis of actuarial process that a managed care organization uses. You saw in the testimony that many emphasis is on the health care needs and health providers. They are operating on a fee for service. But if you have a home visiting program or a grant funded community support program, they often have an open door policy so families that need the services can benefit. And yet this would transition all of those through a managed care approach.
You have said that it doesn't do enough to preserve the family, that there aren't the services that to try to salvage that. And ultimately, if it can be salvaged and that child is safe, that is going to be the best outcome for that child.
Yeah, our shared goal is that families thrive and succeed, and children are supported by their biological family, and they have the support they need. We hear a lot about the supply problem of needing more foster families. How do we support foster families? And the work they're doing is crucial. Absolutely need to support them in any way we can, but we also need to do something about the demand for foster care. How do we invest in the innovative programs, the effective programs that actually help strengthen families so they can stay together, and we reduce the need for out-of-home placement or placement with a caregiver, a kinship, grandparent, and so forth.
Now, Mr. Hickman, this afternoon in Health, the House Health Committee, it was successful. One of the amendments that you wanted to see passed, and that was the ombudsman, that was needed in the system, and that successfully passed.
And that was a modest improvement to make sure that there's a separate point of contact for people who have complaints about the system. There is a client services office at DHHR where people can call in complaints, but this would make one person responsible for being an advocate for that family, for that child, in that complaint process. And I
think there was also mention that we should just, in slowing down, wait for the implementation of a federal act, the Family First Prevention Services Act. What is it, and why does it behoove West Virginia to just slow down a little bit and wait until this kicks in?
Well, it's a major change in the way states will operate their child welfare services. In the past, the incentive was to remove the child from the home, and then you would get the federal reimbursement. This flips that on its head. It allows you to do some preventive services that are much needed. Different reimbursement rate than the current Medicaid program, lots of other wonky things that people probably don't want to hear about, but it does make it possible for us to invest in more preventive services with a population that traditionally has been involuntary. Your child is removed, you're mandatorily required to participate in something if you want that child to remain in the home. So that's a new twist. That's a different way than we have provided those kinds of in-home support services in the past.
It is such a big bill. We're only scratching the surface of it. It seems like there's the managed care piece and then the child welfare piece. And there was testimony this morning that it should just be separated because it is so big. Mr. McKay, let me ask you that over and over we heard this morning that there has been an absence of input from stakeholders. Now, does that mean in coming up with this legislation or in the design, the process that it is proposing, the bill proposes, that there's a lack of stakeholder input?
There's been a lack of input really in all of those aspects, and we feel like it's really important to have the lived experience of families who have children who are part of the child welfare system, foster families and kinship caregivers who are helping provide the services and being a resource for those children as they open their homes to provide care and nurture children who have been removed due to abuse and neglect. We want those voices, and largely they've been missing from the process. There have been a couple of public hearings and moments, but that tends to be just an opportunity to chime in. It's not really sitting at the table in a participatory way to develop the solutions. We feel that the closer decisions are made to the children, to the people who are affected by the decisions, the more likely they are to benefit from those decisions. And so we feel like community-based decisions, family-based decisions, and the lived experience of biological families, grandparents raising their children, and foster parents themselves is crucial as we move forward with reforming our child welfare system.
Well, both of you, again, you were at the meeting this afternoon. Do you think your messages from the public hearing were delivered? Are lawmakers hearing what you're requesting, what you're asking for?
I think there was a lot of hesitation on the part of members of the committee to try and tease out additional information. I think people did respond in part to the feeling that things were being rushed. And from my experience with the quote-unquote stakeholder process has been that DHHR has come in and said, here's what we want to do. How will you help us do this?
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank both of you. I'm sorry we're out of time, but we're going to continue to follow this. Sam Hickman, of the National Association of Social Workers, West Virginia chapter, and Jim McKay from Prevent Child Abuse West Virginia. Thank you both.
Thank you.
3,800 National Service volunteers work in West Virginia each year under the leadership of Volunteer West Virginia, the state's commission. Denight Belai spoke with commission members on a recent visit to the Capitol.
In 2018, West Virginia ranked first in the nation for enrolling AmeriCorps members. This year, Volunteer West Virginia officials say they want to highlight the work they've done across the state.
In West Virginia, we don't have a lot to give, but we give everything we have. So by nature, West Virginians are very giving and compassionate people, and we like to help one another. So the reason why we think more West Virginians serve in AmeriCorps is because it's just our nature, really.
National service programs like AmeriCorps, VISTA, and Senior Corps are responsible for supporting more than 600 nonprofits, schools, and service agencies in the Mountain State.
The national service programs cover such a wide array of services, so education, economic impact. Basically, I mean, one of my favorite goals is that we empower West Virginians to help themselves. So you're able to step in this position where you can make a huge impact in the state, and I feel that it's helping to build the West Virginia of our future.
One of the programs, the West Virginia Community Development Hub, sponsors VISTA projects that contribute to community engagement, advancement, and renewal.
VISTAs and the West Virginia Hub in general, we help revitalize West Virginia. We give community members and communities the resources they need, the expertise that they need to grow and thrive and create sustainable solutions for lasting change.
The Hub's services range from addressing abandoned and dilapidated properties to working in different programs and providing microgrants so that communities can take on projects to regenerate their communities.
Organizations like the Hub and the organizations that we partner with and work with across the state are really the change makers that progress our state and move forward.
Ryan says the Hub partners with West Virginia communities to empower members to become the change agents they want to see in their community. For the Legislature Today, I'm Danai Balai.
Tomorrow on the Legislature Today, a focus on the growing oil and gas industry in West Virginia, including the perspective of property owners who believe their rights are being violated. I'm Suzanne Higgins. For everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thanks for joining us tonight. Have a great evening.